Welcome back. I'm glad to introduce you to the second panel entitled Inversions, When Narrative Becomes Institutions, which continue to interrogate the canon narrative, some of the structure architectures discussed in the previous panel, seeking under possible transformation the challenges that this implies and sometimes their impossibilities. How does one do things with canon narratives? How does one deconstruct and reconstruct them in the order to accommodate other realities and historical experiences, such as histories of oppression, indigenous ontologies and practices, and critics of nation? This panel invites us to the flip sides of the canonic and the unconscious of modernity. Yesterday, we explored the Museum in Exile for the Palestinian People by the 1978 International Art Exhibition for Palestine. We continue today with a talk by Lara Caldi entitled The Renegade Object and the Hollow Museum on the Current State of the Museums in Palestine. Here, Lara Caldi continues to examine and reflect on the contemporary situation of museums in Palestine, although over the past few years there has been an accelerated desire and an actual proliferation of buildings of several museums and archive projects in Palestine, those projects have triggered an array of debates and questions, and their opening have been constantly failing. Her talk will begin with a short story of a possible counter-museum, and it will follow by an overview of the current Palestinian museums under construction. Lara Caldi is an independent curator based in Jerusalem. She's currently teaching at the International Academy of Art in Ramallah. Among others, Caldi curated the exhibition Father, Can't You See I'm Burning? At the Appel Art Center in Amsterdam in 2014. And she's opening in April, very soon, an art space in Ramallah called The Copy Room. Please help me to welcome Lara.
In 2012, I was co-curating the Jerusalem Show, which is an annual exhibition at Al-Ma'mal Art Foundation and different venues in the Old City of Jerusalem. Eric Beltran, one of the invited artists, started a research project about the First Intifada, or First Uprising of 1987. He was interested in that generation's resistance to speak, and in the manashir, or communiques, issued by the unified national leadership of the uprising in the late 80s, which mobilized the Palestinians while under occupation, under military occupation, and it was circulated in order to inform populations of the date, time for demonstrations, for example, or strikes, or acts of civil disobedience, as well as communicate political statements about recent events. Eric asked me whom he could interview. I assumed I would start with my closest surroundings. I told him stories I had heard, that along with other comrades, my parents might actually have been involved in printing the communiques in one city and smuggling them into another, in strollers placed underneath their daughters and sons. The communiques would be disseminated, read, and instantly destroyed. Sometimes the sudden change of circumstances, like a military campaign or the arrest of a prominent party member, would deem it dangerous to distribute them, and the group in charge of the dissemination would be stuck with piles of them that they were forced to destroy at once without any evidence which would attract attention, like a fire, for example. One of the urban myths around the First Intifada is that stacks of those communiques are buried deep in people's backyards, or were dumped in liquid concrete about to be plastered, becoming the very concrete structures of the city. It is said that in various former activists' backyards and in various walls, they are buried, dormant, are the material archives of the First Intifada. Eric wanted to interview people that might have been involved, so I took him to see a friend of my father's. At the meeting, my father and his friend questioned Eric about where he's from in Mexico, quizzed him about political affiliations, asked of his opinions about massacres of Native Americans, about what he thought of Israeli occupation. Eric finally asked about their involvement in the First Intifada. In answer, they claimed that they were not involved actively at all. Even as witnesses, they did not have much to say, more than what is already common knowledge. Much later, they explained to me why they were both so guarded. It was very simple. While my generation sees the First Intifada as part of the history of the Palestinian struggle, one to speak, write, research, and make projects about, the generation of my father, of the First Intifada, see it as ongoing. They cannot speak about it because they understand that they might jeopardize and compromise former comrades, and that there were still unresolved cases that people could go to Israeli's prisons for. More so, there were Palestinian political detainees and prisoners who are still in Israeli prisons since the First Intifada. Although they know and are certain the First Intifada is over, has been over since the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1993, was even followed by what they call a pastiche intifada, they refuse to speak of the experience. They understand that once they speak of it, once it's aesthetized, in a sense, once it's exhibited, museumized, then that would mean its true death, when it is no longer deemed dangerous knowledge, when it is no longer threatening authority and power, only then will they be able to talk about it. They are also aware that the power lies in its burial and that it needs to remain dormant, that it is buried deep in the land itself in order for it to resurrect one day. It is a fugitive archive. There are archives which are forgotten, which the archive ignores or refuses to include. But here it is the archive which refuses to be included, not only because it refuses to be complicit with what the archive signifies, but also because it is aware that it needs to protect itself from an imminent threat. These objects and archives that could work as evidence to prove and criminalize their user must remain unearthed, but they also remain as the potential that lurks beneath the ground. The renegade object is that which resists entering the museum, as it is aware that once it enters the museum, it will be deemed obsolete. Over the past few years, there has been a proliferation of museum building in Palestine. While a few have managed to open, most of the museums have been failing to. This project, or paper, is an attempt at reading both this proliferation and its inherent failure, whether actual, in the sense that some of those museums have been expected to open for the past 3 years and have been postponing, or symbolic, in the sense that a Palestinian museum is somewhat impossible. These projects pose questions about the institution of the museum as such and has the potential to reveal and change it. Conversely, the institution of the museum provokes questions about the current local context. These museums are symptomatic of many failures, be it of the failure of the institution of the museum, revealing its complicity with the nation state and its historical relationship with colonialism, or a symptomatic death and perhaps failure of a politics of emancipation. Palestinian museums are empty museums, devoid of collections, because the material culture is either confiscated, destroyed, or lies in colonial museums or secret military archives. Under current circumstances, an unrecognized state, a lack of sovereignty in the legal sense, those museums cannot be loyal to the promise of every other museum to preserve and protect the objects which enter it. And so to collect and exhibit whatever remaining original objects would be an implicit gesture of denying the present political circumstances. We are all aware, of course, of the long history of criticism of the institution of the museum and its semblance to the mausoleum and relationship to death. Hence, the impossibility of these museums, represented by their emptiness, presents a great opportunity at thinking through a museum without collections or original objects, but is also symptomatic of an inherent resistance to announcing, exhibiting this history of a certain politics. Many other questions and conditions make Palestinian museums impossible. For example, as my friend Haitham Wardani noted, a Palestinian museum is primarily a museum of the oppressed, which is paradoxical because the form with which the institution of the museum represents history whether of art or any other genre, its structure compels a coherent linear narrative, which is a form that in fact oppresses the voices of the oppressed. In addition, the institution of the museum has an umbilical cord connected to the institution of the state, so that we can read one through the other. In the case of the Palestinians, with the absence of the state, does the museum function as that imagined autonomous space? Does it represent the desire for a state? Is it symptomatic of a rigid nationalist agenda? Or could it be a more open museum which needs to speak with other oppressed people? How is this relationship negotiated? And how does a stateless museum function differently from a museum inside a national state? Indeed, what would a museum of the oppressed look like? These are not questions which I answer. Those are rather questions which this recent proliferation of the institution of the museum generates. Actually, those, just to note, I mean, these questions are very similar to ones which were instigated by the very well-known project by artist Khaled Harani called Picasso in Palestine, where a room at the International Art Academy, Palestine, was converted into a humidity and security-controlled room to house a painting by Picasso, which was loaned and arduously shipped from the Van Abbe Museum in Holland to Ramallah in 2011. So in order for you to understand, I mean, this current kind of advent of museum building, perhaps I thought I could describe some of those museums to you. This one is within the presidential compound in Ramallah. And this is the Yasser Arafat Museum, and it's a kind of memorial museum. It's a project of the Palestinian Authority under the Yasser Arafat Foundation, which was founded in 2006. The museum has not opened yet. It's under construction. The honorary chairman of the board is the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, while the actual chairman is Arafat's nephew and former foreign minister, Dr. Nasser al-Qudwe. The museum was designed by Palestinian-Jordanian architect Jafar Tuqan, who also designed the Mahmoud Darwish Museum, which opened 2 years ago in 2012, and it hosts a very small permanent collection of the renowned poet, Mahmoud Darwish. But to go back to the Yasser Arafat Museum, this is inside the museum, so it's basically it's going to host a permanent exhibition of Palestinian history from the last 100 years, with naturally an emphasis on the history of the PLO throughout. The corridor is going upwards. There are about four ramps until it's, you know, leading to the former headquarters of the late president. You could see the rooms and the meeting, you know, the private bedroom and the meeting room of the late president while he was under siege from 2002 till 2004 in the presidential compound. I mean, objects that will be exhibited are some of the gifts given to Yasser Arafat from people and different presidents. Different people is that there is a ongoing debate about how to show this history, which periods to emphasize, for example, besides the Nakba, the different intifadas. But it is a very kind of national. It's a very kind of selective PLO-centric historical timeline. Actually, while I was... So outside this museum, there is, of course, the grave of the late president Yasser Arafat. And so it is a mausoleum in that sense. And actually, while I was visiting this image of the two guards guarding the grave, reminded me very much of the Picasso in Palestine project, where it's exactly, you know, this same image. And I think, you know, Khaled Hourani, I mean, funny enough, Khaled Hourani is also involved in the Yasser Arafat museum in different ways. He sits on the board. But I think, I mean, he was very aware of all these kind of problematics while he was also working on his project, Picasso in Palestine. So the other museum, I mean, this is just another view from inside the museum to the outside. The other museum, which is also under construction and set to open this year, is the Palestinian Museum in Birzeit. The project was started in 1998 by the Welfare Association as a Nakba memorial museum at the beginning, but soon changed into a more open structure when the board hired Palestinian-American academic Bshara Domani, who is now professor of modern Middle Eastern history at Brown University, where he put this idea of the satellite museums, so that the building at Birzeit is only one part, and where other satellite museums, wherever there is Palestinian diaspora around the world, will host exhibitions. Indeed, this is still the case. In May, while the building in Birzeit opens, another exhibition by the Palestinian Museum titled At the Seams, A Political History of Palestinian Embroidery, will open at in Beirut. The Palestinian Museum has been publishing research for the past 2 years, which I quote and use in this paper, and also participating in cultural events in Palestine before its official inauguration. There's a very specific focus on research, which is historical, factual research, I think. So, for example, one of the projects of the museum is the Palestine Historical Timeline, which is being developed in collaboration with the Institute for Palestine Studies. And as you can guess from the title, it is a historical timeline of modern Palestinian history. So very similar to the Yasser Arafat Museum. This historical timeline is going to be online. It was being worked on as an online kind of part of the museum. Other projects are family album, and I mean, it is not clear whether the museum will be housing a collection yet, and of what exactly. Until very recently, the plan was to host an archive of documents and images, but the building indicates that it will be hosting a collection of artifacts. The exhibition hall, which is actually the smallest part of the museum. It's a very small museum. The exhibition hall is 500 meters square, has no natural light. I mean, is clearly designed for preserving a permanent collection. I mean, most of the museum is dedicated to storage areas. And it's designed by a Dublin firm, Hannigan Peng Architects. It's on top of the hill of a hill in Birzeit, right next to the main Palestinian university, Birzeit University, right next to the campus. And it's 15 minutes away from Ramallah, north of Ramallah. Other museums, so this is the garden, where the plants are kind of indigenous Palestinian plants. Other museums which are under construction, you know, quickly, is Al-Ruwaya, or Narrative Museum in Beit Lahem, still hasn't opened, City of Ramallah Museum, the Museum of Natural History in Beit Sahour, the Museum of Destroyed Villages, many others, also abroad. I mean, there's a really interesting a museum that has recently been announced. It's, I mean, interesting in parallel to the exhibition of Rasha and Christine here. It's the Modern and Contemporary Art Museum Palestine, which historian, poet, and UNESCO Palestinian representative Elias Sanbar is working on, where works of art are being donated by international artists. Already, I think they have tens of works in the collection, and will remain in the custody of the Institute of Institut du Monde Arabe in Paris, and probably tour until they can eventually return to Jerusalem, where the museum will eventually be. Actually, Elias Sanbar gave a really interesting paper at when this same exhibition was exhibited in Makba. He gave a talk titled Musée de la Vide, a museum full of emptiness, explaining that a Palestinian museum should be a museum full of emptiness, with different anecdotes. Other museums, there are online museums, like, for example, an online Nakba museum, which is a private endeavor funded by a Qatari philanthropists. This is a really strange museum that opened about a year ago. It's the Russian Museum in Jericho, and it's built on this land previously owned by a Russian, the Tsar, and then handed back over to Russia in 2008 by the Imperial Orthodox Palestine Society. So you have these museums mushrooming, these different museums. Yeah. Palestinian museums are museums of the future, really. I mean, not the past. One assumes that every museum contains objects that were made in a chronological kind of order that has already passed. The Palestinian museum's objects belong to the future because they are not yet at the museum. Palestinian museums are really empty museums. In an unpublished manuscript titled Heritage and the Struggle for Palestine, author Chiara De Cesari traces the blueprints of Palestinian public museums in the end of the 90s and early 2000s and their failures. De Cesari writes, "In spite of the richness of the archaeology of the region, one of the problems of the Palestinian Authority museums is the lack of artifacts. The majority of movable Palestinian cultural property is in Jerusalem or in Israel or in the collections of international colonial institutions such as British, like the British Museum." End of quote. The lack of objects, artifacts, or art collections in Palestine is due to the dispersal of the Palestinians and their material belongings, the confiscation of land since the Nakba of 1948. And the British mandate before that. Most museums under construction, like the Palestinian Museum and another museum, which is Al-Riwaya Museum in Beit Lahem, which are due to open in Ramallah and Beit Lahem in 2016, will not be exhibiting objects, or at least their present collections consist of video and audio material, which are stories about objects and events. In fact, also the Yasser Arafat Museum uses a lot of audio and visual material. In a booklet called Al-Matahif Al-Falastiniya, or Palestinian Museums, published in 2014 by the Palestinian Museum, accompanying a pre-opening exhibition, 39 Palestinian museums are listed, of which three are outside historical Palestine. The museums representing individuals like Mahmoud Darwish, like poet Mahmoud Darwish, do have a collection of personal objects. However, when it comes to more collective museums, those are mostly either exhibiting scarce and dubious kind of archaeological objects, heritage objects, or folkloric objects, as most of the museums contain everyday garments and objects that Palestinian individuals gifted to the museums. One of the really my favorite examples is an object exhibited at a museum called the Palestinian Heritage Museum in Tyre, in Lebanon, in Sur. And it's a sewing needle from pre-1948. The label explains that it is a Palestinian needle from before the Nakba, courtesy Khaled Khashan and her mother-in-law, the late Ghazaleh Mahmoud, 12th February 2006. The label refers to a needle which the two ladies carried with them from Palestine when they became refugees during the Nakba of 1948. And one is sure that what Khaled left in Palestine were many more objects and belongings than this very needle. One cannot help but ask what made Khaled give away the needle, as there is nothing about the needle that actually looks like it was manufactured and used pre-1948, right, in Palestine. But that is because Khaled and the museum curators are very aware that it is the museum which makes the needle look like it is pre-1948 and not the object itself. The museum's mission, this particular museum in Tyre, is to collect objects from Palestinians pre-1948. Most of the museums listed, especially the two in refugee camps in Lebanon, are small heritage museums whose mission is to prove to the Israelis and the world that the Palestinians did inhabit Palestine before 1948. It is worth to note here that the Palestinian Museum also started out as a project for a museum for Palestine pre-1948, one that is very similar to those small dispersed museums, but on a bigger scale. And one of the problems that it had was that it could not locate, according to the museum, nor collect objects that it could exhibit. All the objects in the aforementioned museums are mundane and personal and kind of unscientific in the sense of a historically sound classification. But most importantly, most of these museums are personal initiatives by public figures in their locales or the community. The second half of these museums, right, and these museums are ones which are, you know, open, functioning, are the museums which the Ministry of Antiquity in the Palestinian Authority opened, mostly in the early 2000s. For example, this one is the Hisham Palace Museum in Jericho. This is a site-specific museum. It's an important early Islamic archaeological site that was excavated by a Palestinian and British archaeologists in 1930s the excavation started in 1930 and ended in 1948. And in 1948, most of the findings were seized by the Israeli authorities and exhibited at the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem instead. The Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem was actually called the Palestinian Archaeology Museum before then. There is also this the Samaritan Museum. It's a museum of the still living Samaritan community's heritage and history in the West Bank. It's a small museum for a Palestinian kind of ethno-religious group closely related to Judaism that have remained in Palestine and are considered the smallest ethno-religious group in the world. The booklet mentions that several Old Testament Torah from the collection of this museum were stolen. Both museums contain few objects on display and of whatever remains after looting and confiscation of objects. However, what is most interesting about these two museums and what seems like a connecting thread in what the Palestinian Authorities Department of Tourism and Antiquity deems important to preserve, renovate, and make public are more site-specific museums, ones where even though most of the objects are looted or have disappeared, the site itself, so in the cases of those museums, the ruins of the Hisham Palace and the living culture of the Samaritans are still visible. It's a kind of symptomatic of of a political desire to show, you know, sovereign power over land on behalf of the Palestinian Authority, kind of exhibition of sovereignty for a coming Palestinian state. Nonetheless, these museums continue to shed their objects. There are many examples and stories of missing and lost Palestinian archives, paintings and objects that could theoretically also be housed by all these museums and the ones due to open shortly, that until this day are still disappeared. One of the most known is the Palestinian organization, PLO's, Palestinian Liberation Organization's film unit, the Palestine Film Archive, which included thousands, which disappeared in 1982 during the Israeli invasion on Beirut. The Palestinian Film Archive included thousands of film reels documenting the Palestinians' everyday life in the diaspora, as well as the armed struggle in Lebanon and abroad. The archive included collaborations on feature and documentaries, such as between the well-known films between the Japanese Red Army and the left-wing Palestinian political parties. This archive disappeared in 1982 during the Israeli invasion, and the loss of this archive has been actually a subject of many Palestinian films, some of which are Kings and Extras by Azza Al Hassan, For Cultural Purposes by Sara Wood, and most recently Off Frame by Muhannad Yaqubi. The whereabouts of this archive were never found out, and there are only stories and oral accounts of what might have happened to it. Some say it has been burnt, looted, dispersed among many Palestinians in an attempt to salvage it, or a combination of all three. But this actual loss, right, or emptiness the archive has produced is what generated a kind of poetic production that is neither nostalgic nor attempts to reassemble the past, but is pointing to the hole in the archive that is caused by the loss of the archive itself. And even more so, it is interesting to compare how the PLO in Lebanon started becoming and acting like a national institution by centralizing archives, which could be read almost as a struggle to, or attempt to enter the canon of history, speaking of canons, with the struggle inside the occupied territories during the First Intifada, where there seems to have been an awareness that the struggle is against the institution represented by the state, right, and embodied by an instant destruction of the means, right, of resistance. So even though there is currently a strong desire to historicize and monumentalize Palestinian national history and identity in order to build upon these foundations a material testimony for a Palestinian nation state, the emptiness that is left by the disappeared, looted, and lost archives and objects resists this pull. Film archives whole exhibitions are, not the only example of lost artworks. It seems that losing objects and artworks became somewhat a Palestinian tradition, one that is not only practiced by the Israelis, but that takes place because the destination of return, usually Palestine, is continuously shifting. In an article titled 17 Lost Exhibitions by Jack Persekian, the former director of the Palestinian Museum, the one in Birzeit, introduces a research project done by the, research done by the Palestinian Museum on lost collections of artworks in Palestinian art exhibition history. Persekian writes, indeed, it was the realization of a pattern. I'm almost done. Okay. Persekian writes, indeed, it was the realization of a pattern of loss not only of single works of art, but of an entire curated exhibitions of Palestinian art displayed all over the world that inspired the Palestinian Museum's latest research project, 17 Lost Exhibitions. The survey was carried out on dispersed exhibitions from the 1970s until 2014, where the information was pieced together from individual and sometimes opposed testimonies by those involved in the exhibitions, as documentation of the exhibitions was scarce or had mostly vanished. The exhibitions chronicle different stories of loss, so sending paintings abroad to Europe or America for an exhibition where the paintings do not find their way back out of negligence, or the artworks tour to different parts of Palestine where they're confiscated by Israeli soldiers in a particular city, or destroyed during clashes. For example, a collection of the Ministry of Culture that disappeared during an Israeli incursion in Ramallah in 2002. Others, for example, are sent for an exhibition in Tunisia to end up as part of the collection of the Tunisian prime minister, and so on. The information in the published research results focuses more on the circumstances of the loss of these artworks rather than which artworks or collections were lost. In Persekian's introduction, which I assume here now, Persekian is kind of expressing a certain narrative of the Palestinian Museum. There seems to be two discourses being communicated simultaneously. One is that the museum's sense of national responsibility, and that this research is conducted partly so that it instigates the process of a kind of repatriation of those artworks. Why else would the Palestinian Museum initiate such research, Persekian writes? In this context, the publication of the newsletter, whose initial investigation into the matter goes deeper than any undertaking so far, was something of a bold move, especially since the research cannot guarantee that it will lead to the successful recuperation of any of the paintings or even the discovery of their exact whereabouts. So it is not really the return of the artworks or even the artworks themselves that are being emphasized by the research again. Somehow, it seems that what Persekian is insinuating is that the museum is where loss is perhaps simply registered, but, and again, another quote. I will skip that because I don't have a lot of time. So one of the underlying messages of the research project is also to disclose that Palestinian heritage and collection is neglected, is not cared for and preserved aptly, right? And at present, the responsible body for this would be the Palestinian Authority's Ministry of Culture. The Palestinian Museum promises that it will act in its place, right? That with its preservative powers, it will protect this loss from taking place again. So I quote from Persekian again. The second motivation for the research, however, is to produce a survey of past exhibitions that shows the mistakes that have been made and the problems that have been encountered, in the hope that we and our fellow institutions across Palestine will be able to learn from them. With the political situation in Palestine remaining as it is, the future of Palestinian art and museums cannot be a certain or a safe one. But with projects like this, we are working to strengthen its foundations and set it on the best possible course. End of quote. So while the Palestinian Museum seems very aware of the very imminent repetitive possibility of loss, and what the exposure of a centralized collection in a museum in Palestine to utter vulnerability means, right, it paradoxically still desires to operate as a protector of this material culture. Again, here one could sense this paradoxical dilemma. A desire to be a sovereign entity is in tension with the history and present of loss, where even the messages of an institution such as the forthcoming Palestinian Museum are themselves conflicting. On one hand, there is a desire to be a totalitarian kind of representative for Palestinian culture, also with the Yasser Arafat kind of historical timeline, and the protector of objects, artifacts, you know, and artworks. Yet on the other hand, it is defined by its inability to do so. It has no collection, it publishes research on lost artworks, it prophesizes its own probable demise, and yet it still plans to open as a fully functioning museum. I'm ending. Okay. I will end with another story. So In one of the interviews of a collection called Never Part, a project which I attempted to work on, which was founded by former director of the museum, Jack Persikian. And it's an assemblage of 280 recorded interviews with Palestinians in Palestine and the diaspora. And each interview is on an object in the possession of the interviewee that he or she is not ready to part with, right? In one of these interviews, a second-generation Palestinian living in Sao Paulo talks about a Greco-Roman amphora that his father gave him. He chronicles that this amphora was excavated from an archaeological site in Safuria, or Sepphoris, in Palestine, by his father along with an American archaeological excavation team in the 1930s. The interviewee's father decided to keep this amphora because he knew the excavated artifacts would end up at a British or an American museum. Thus, the amphora in this case needs to be protected from the colonial museum, and its disappearance alludes to kind of a lurking continued resistance of colonialism. So, you know, the son keeps this amphora, and for him it becomes the embodiment of all these stories and his connection with Palestine, right? The Palestinian Museum presents it as an individual story with an object. And the plan is to exhibit it, exhibit the interview, right, at some point. But, you know, when we saw this interview, we were unsure as whether to exhibit it, because we imagined that in a few years, perhaps, when the Palestinian state perhaps is recognized, that the Palestinian State Museum will actually use this video to claim this very same amphora as stolen, no, property. Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of never-ending paradox with these museums, I guess. And on this note, yeah, thank you.